Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. And as always, hit that subscribe button, everybody. We have an amazing show for you all, because joining the mothership is J. Allen Williams. He's the co-writer and director of the movie Mead, coming to theaters on August 9th. Now come join me as we go Traversing the Stars. Hello, Mr. Williams. Thank you for coming to see Traversing the Stars podcast.
You bet, Jeff. We got two Jeffs here.
Indeed. It's a total pleasure to talk with you. I really have been fascinated by what I've been hearing about Mead.
Good. Thank you. Fascinating is good, says Mr. Spock.
Indeed. So we start off with a question of inspiration. So what inspired your love for filmmaking and who are your earliest influences?
Oh, boy. Well, I guess it'd be Disney, because my great-grandparents used to drop me off when I was between the ages of 7 and 9 years old by myself with a bag of popcorn and a can of pop, cutting my teeth on things like Snow White and the Seven Dwarves and Fantasia. First time I ever saw animated boobs, you know. That's going to inspire an 8-year old, you know.
we all have our life's goals.
We all have our life's goals, yeah. Our important things.
Indeed.
That's two of them.
So I read that you actually moved from Mississippi to Kansas to attend the Kansas City Art Institute. So why the Kansas City Art Institute? And what was your primary focus of study when you went there?
Okay, well, actually, I was born in Biloxi on the Air Force Base, Keesler Air Force Base, because my dad was an Air Force guy. And actually, we moved to the Ozark, southwestern Missouri, just right after that. So I pretty much grew up there. I lived in Florida a little bit, moved around, but mostly in the Ozarks. And Kansas City Art Institute is 3 hours north of Springfield. And it was one of the art institutes. It was one of the 13 schools in the United States to go to. Later in life, I found out that Richard Corbin, one of the inspirations of my life and career, went there exactly 20 years before me.
Nice.
Richard, the writer, and myself, our birthdays are all within 5 days. You know, mine's September, Richard's is October. Anyway, so Richard had gone there, but I didn't know that at the time. And I went in there with my portfolio, and some of his stuff was in there from the comic books I was reading when I was, you know, a kid, and said, I want to be like this guy. And they said, you're an idiot. We're not going to let you in. And then I found out from Corb's wife, just a few months ago, I told her that. I'd never told Richard that. And I told her that. And she goes, oh, my God. He went in with his artwork. He didn't have yours because you were a baby. But he went in and they said the same thing to him. And look at what we did. And yeah, one of the things the guy said to me was, they will never make a movie from a comic book. Ain't gonna happen.
Apparently, yeah. They're able to tell the future very well back then.
No, but me and Richard could, and I only had that foresight because of him. But anyway, yeah, I studied animation. I did a lot of cell animation, you know, where you have the pen registered acetate and you draw the black on the front and paint the back, and learned how to do a little of that. Did a little bit of science fiction photography, trying to work with compositing and blue screen. Those came out horribly and thank God don't exist. I've been animating since I was 9 or 10 years old, if you count drawing in the corner of your math book and then getting almost suspended for that. So
seriously, for flip books?
Drawing in the math book, you know.
In the actual book you were drawing.
Yeah. In
the 70s. No, I thought you were drawing the cover, the inside of the book. That's a crime.
I think it was a death sentence for kids back then. So I got lucky. I didn't get put down.
But now, though, if someone had those books, they're probably worth money. Be like, oh, this is J. Williams's work before he became a famous director of Mead.
I'm sure it's on eBay for $300,000. I'm sure it's there. Go look. It's got a red cover. That's all I remember.
So, I mean, you've had an amazing career. You created a computer game called Dark Sword. You were actually in a band as well. What like which when you were when you joined the band, what were you how certain were you that your life was going to be in music instead of film? For a little while, were you thinking, that offshoot that you're going to be a rock star?
Well, that was the hope. I've always done lots of different stuff, and I don't think I ever at any point thought I'd only do one thing. In the 80s we got a record deal, and then we were in the kind of the hard rock thing, like Dokken and Winger and things like that. And then came Seattle, and we all lost our record contract. So right when I came to the party, it was almost over. But I was always doing other stuff too, and I never stopped doing kind of film type projects. And that's really when I started kind of migrating into doing stuff for the entertainment industry. I was mostly in the advertising industry, and I did music videos and things like that. But it kind of forced me more seriously into that. I still do music, but that's mostly for myself. Nobody buys music anymore.
At least maybe one song at a time on iTunes, perhaps.
One song at a time by about seven different people.
Right.
And it's
Well,
all auto-tuned.
that now that part is 100% correct. It has gone from auto-tunes being something like a little secret to now it's a sign of status to actually be able to auto-tune your music. Give that
Yeah.
electronic twang, which always sounds artificial and weird.
Yeah, it's generally I've been told in your contract, you sign a contract with RCA or whoever books people these days, that you will be auto-tuned. And so I'm kind of glad to be out of that. I don't own it. I have Pro Tools. I don't use it. It reminds me of animation these days because like the Unreal Engine is what they're using on Mandalorian, and it's wonderful. I mean, it's incredible. Don't get me wrong. It looks so real, but it does itself, and it reminds me of auto-tune for singers. And that's why I do it the hard way. I do it in 80 to 100 layers deep in After Effects after rendering it out of using the stock rendering engine in 3D Studio Max. And it's just got more of a hand done look. And that's so far what I prefer. But you never know. If we start doing things where I want to get something done faster than 6 years, I may have to rethink that. But right now, I do it the way I do it.
Well, I mean, one thing I was amazed by, and reading about you is the remarkable level of determination and patience you must have. Going back to the idea of Dark Souls, which is a computer game, an interactive movie called Dark Star, you did that over a 10-year period, is what I read about that. Now, that's a level of determination that is kind of hard to fathom in this world of instant gratification. So, what led to that confidence to keep plugging away at this thing to make sure it got done the way you wanted it done?
Three letters, OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And as far as confidence, everything I've ever done is a tool to deal with lack of self-esteem. Everything. I mean, I never liked myself very much. I didn't think I was good at anything. And really, my family kind of echoed that and perhaps planted that seed. So I thought I sucked. And one thing I tell students when I talk in front of a group of them is, there's a term called fake it till you make it, because you're always going to suck at first. You're always going to suck. You're never going to come out of the egg knowing what you're doing. And that's where talents come from. I don't believe you're imbued with talent. I believe you find that talent within yourself and you bring it out and you do it in your own way by creating stuff that's important to you. With anything I've ever done, I've made sure it was within the parameters of my own wheelhouse, my own skill set. For example, I didn't want to go learn the Unreal Engine, not just because it was too damn easy, but I already had my system before I started Made, and that's what I was comfortable working in.
Now, when you're working on something for 10 years, is there a point where you're thinking to yourself, this is just never going to happen? Where does the doubt start kicking in? And then once that doubt kind of starts eating away, how do you then push it away and go, this is screw it, I'm just going to get it done?
Well, it's like if you get thrown into the ocean and you're swimming and you go, God, I'm going to be swimming forever. You don't stop swimming. What happened on Dark Star? I was 2.5 years into it, laying in bed one night, and everything was swirling through my head. Okay, I got this to do. I got this to do. And it just hit me that night. It was the closest I've had to abject horror because I realized I've got at least another 5 or 6 years in this. It was only 8.5 years of actual production, but about a year and a half of it was Hollywood negotiations. I mean, when we first started the band, Rush was providing all the music. We had to find our distributors and all that. And there was a huge monkey wrench because of the 2008 recession, and it made it very difficult on all fronts. So, yeah, I had that realization just a few years in. And yeah, what do you do? I don't think I skipped a beat, but I was very depressed for several months, thinking this is my life for a lot longer than I wanted to be. But it was too late. I was already in it, and there wasn't any going back.
So what did that process teach you? And then how does your experience on Darkstar later help you with Mead, as we'll go into just a moment or two?
Well, during the making of Darkstar is when I first started animating in CGI. So it was like film school for me. And that's one of the things that made Darkstar really a good thing to do. And I'd do it again, because I came out of it with skills that I wouldn't have had, you know, 8.5 years of learning how to do it and creating my own system. Jim Lammers of Trinity Animation, who does the show Archer, the animation for that, he described me, you know, my system, you know, how odd it is, and that it's amazing that it even works, but it does. And that's a major benefit that came from, you know, Darkstar. But also, it's like, you know, that anything good is, you got to put the work in. It takes time, especially if you're doing, you know, so much of it all by yourself with no help.
And the fascinating thing is, especially nowadays, where so much of the animation is done by major studios, I mean, whether or not it's Disney or DreamWorks or things of that nature, you are doing this on your own. That takes some serious balls, in my opinion.
Yeah. I prefer the word stones.
Stones.
That boy's got some stones. Yeah. Well, I don't see it that way, because it just, these things, I don't do them, they do me, you know, so it's just kind of automatic. But yeah, you look at any given sci-fi movie, and you've got six columns wide of animators and compositors, and it rolls for 7 minutes. I mean, on any MCU movie or Star Wars movie, here's my credits, you know, oh, there he went. I think I saw J. Allen Williams. No, I don't know.
So, as we were mentioning, you're the director and co-writer of Mead. So it's based on a comic book by, I'm going to get the guy's name wrong, Jan Sternad?
Sternad. Everybody Sternad. Well, don't feel bad, because as a 12-year-old, I thought it was Jan Sternad.
Sternad.
Jan. I thought he was, hey, it's a Swedish writer. Jan Sternad and Richard Corbin. I don't know if you know who that is, but that's one of the most famous, prolific comic artists of all time. That was their first project in 1972 together, in a comic called Fever Dreams. And that was his first collaborative effort with him. And yeah, Jan, almost tried to call him Jan. Jan is just a prolific writer. He's a crusty old bastard, but he's just become one of my best friends. Incredible writer. He's a novelist. He did about 20 Star Wars novels. He worked at Disney for about 20 years, did Goof Troop, Darkwing Duck, and he wrote the second Aladdin movie.
I did not know any of that information.
That was the one with Castanello, because Robin Williams was pissed at Disney at the time, but he came back for the third one.
Right. So you got the unfortunate Aladdin one without Robin Williams.
Yeah, but hell, not everybody can say that they're the author of a Disney film. You know,
that part is exactly right. Well, the one that got me was Darkwing Duck, because that was my childhood. So I was like, Aladdin's fine. Darkwing Duck, I was like, son of a bitch, I got to talk to this guy.
That's right, man. Well, see, I didn't know any of this. I knew he'd worked with Disney, but I when I asked him, I knew, he said, I think I did a few Star Wars novels. I said, well, send me the links to the covers, and I was going to use it in our making of documentary that we did. And it was over 20 of them. And so I didn't know that. And I didn't know about Return to Jafar. I found out about Darkwing Duck and Goof Troop on my own. He doesn't talk about himself. He's so opposite your L.A. Personality, because he's from Wichita, Kansas. And that's another thing about Richard, Jan, and I. We all lived since our childhoods about 3 hours away from each other.
Oh, wow.
The odds of that, to me, are amazing.
Right. So,
we're all Midwestern guys. We got a whole different vibe, you know. Not saying it's a good thing, but it's just different.
So what was it about his work, you said Fever Dreams, that captured your imagination? I mean, Not only that, though, but what was about you that he thought himself, I can trust this guy with my stuff? Which,
oh, well, I started with Richard. I'd been working with Richard for 20 some years. And I, again, I was a little kid when I said, I'm going to make a movie out of this. And I never told him that. And I produced about a 2-minute demo to prove to myself it was going to look good enough. And I sent it to Richard, and he loved it. Just said, yes, let's do this. And he introduced me to Jan, and Jan loved it too. And I already had the screenplay completely written. And then Jan said, well, do you mind if I, you know, help punch it up? And, you know, to me, Richard Corbin was God, and Jan was writing for God. So how would I say no to that? So I said yes, and I loved working with the guy. It was a whole evolution of getting to know each other and trusting each other. I don't think he trusted me 100% at first. And as we went on, we both really just got very close and wrote, I think, a great screenplay from a 16-page comic. I mean, the movie's 105 minutes long.
So when you're moving from a comic book that you love and grew up loving to changing it to a screenplay, what is the level of pressure in adapting something that you have such an attachment to? Was it harder for you to change it, cut it, alter it to make it something to a screenplay, or because you loved it so much, it was a natural change for you or adaptation for you?
Jeff, yes, good questions.
Oh, thank you.
abject, terrified, because it wasn't cutting anything. The comic could be a storyboard for the film. Every single frame in the comic is in the film. Problem was, that was a 16-page comic book that took 10 minutes to read the entire story, right? So it only had 3 characters in it. One didn't even have a name. And so I have 60 actors in this film. We had to create characters, situations, new things for me to do. Create 3 acts, have this thing flow. I mean, writing a screenplay is the hardest thing a writer will ever do. I mean, it just is. It has to have all these payoffs for the audience as you go. You got to get to the end and be sure that they cared about every one of your characters in your damn story. If you didn't do it, you've lost them a long time ago. So when I watch this film with focus groups, and I've seen it on the big screen twice already with people in there, and when they cry at the end, I know I kept them. I like writing comedy, and most of the Mead script, most of comedy is from me, and most of the sci-fi intrigue and stuff is from Jan, although he's got some funny lines in there too. But one of our favorite things to do is to mix adventure with comedy, make them laugh. You know, a lot of the movies coming out now, like Guardians of the Galaxy is a great example. It does a good job at that. Deadpool. You know, where there's, you still got the danger, but you're laughing at the bad guy, but he can kill you. And so that's something that I love, but that's the task. You keep the audience all the way to the end, and it ain't easy. And this film, I'm very proud to say, does that because of the collaborative effort between Jan and I, but also Richard, because Richard's a storyteller too. He's written a lot of his own things. He adapted lots of Edgar Allan Poe stories, almost all of the big ones. And so it was like elements from 3 storytellers that it meshed perfectly. Jan and I would never compromise to come up with some watered down thing we both liked. We never did. And we had little arguments, you know, most of them through email, and fought for our ideas. And finally, if it was something we were willing to fall on our sword for, Jan, I'm just not doing it. Or Jan saying, this is stupid. Why'd you put that in our movie?
Right.
And I got to tell you, the best relationships come from that kind of interaction. And I just respect Jan so much. And of course, Richard, like I say, he was like my creative dad. You know, he was just an amazing man. And unfortunately, passed away December of 2020 while we were producing. And never got to see the finished film, but his widow is still very close to the production, and I know he loved what we did up to that point. And his widow loves the film, says so in our behind the scenes documentary. And I'm glad that I was able to, you know, make the Corbin studio happy.
So when you took a 16-page comic book and you stretched it to, or made it into, adapted it to a 104-minute movie, what were the threads that you pulled on from the comic book that could then you found could easily be further developed or adapted to a feature film?
Well, that's a good question too. I just basically, one thing that was great and made writing a killer screenplay easy was Jan had already done the heavy lifting. We had the arc. We had the payoffs. We had the twist. We had all that. That was in place. We just had to fill in the gaps, you know, to make the adventure flow and go from here to here. And it really wasn't that hard. It kind of wrote itself, you know. It was fun to do. As you know, Mead's superpower is creating illusions that nobody can tell if it's real or not. And right. Even when you know he's doing it, I mean, imagine he makes you see another world. What are you going to do? You can't see the real world. You can't push the right buttons. You're screwed, you know. So we just took his stuff, and it was so fun to write different scenarios. Like I wrote the poker game where it's a 5-card Mead, and these four ships are coming to kill him. So this big giant fake poker table appears with these cards that are like 50 feet tall, and he deals a hand, and they're just like, and stuff like that, you know, coming up with new things that were similar to what Richard and Jan had come back up with 50 years ago, 3 years after Star Trek with Kirk and Spock, 5 years before Star Wars.
Yeah.
So our sci-fi is more from Forbidden Planet and This Island Earth than it is Star Wars or anything else. So we've got an IP that if anybody comes to me and says, hey, you know, you copied this, then I just say, that's all I'll say, you know.
Right. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, as a 12-year-old, you love this comic book. And then in 2020, you launch a Kickstarter to help fund Mead. Why was that the right time to launch? Like, at what point did you think, now I'm ready to do this, I can do a Kickstarter? And how confident were you that you were going to hit your goal? And did you have an alternative for what would happen if you didn't?
Yeah, that's very interesting. Nothing would have happened. COVID is what gave us time and incentive to, well, let's do, we needed to find something to do because we had the story written. I just about had the animations all done. I mean, the movie was done before I brought in actors. They were able to look at the whole movie without them in it. So we had time, and I thought, you know, at the time we were only going to do Patton Oswalt, and I'd already paid him. So that was all done. He was in the movie. And then I just started thinking, you know, I'd like to add some more names. And so we decided to do the Kickstarter thing. And I knew we'd hit our goals. There was a huge Richard Corbin fan base that was really excited about it. We tested the waters a little bit. But here's the thing, my friend. Our prizes were so expensive that we actually printed a big giant version of the comic, you know, for the Kickstarter prize. This is a very expensive thing to do. You know, it's got the whole comic in here, you know. And we did that. We also giving away Blu-rays and DVDs. Those are expensive. All the shipping, prop prices. I mean, some of the actual laser gun props, Picardo's electric hand prop. But it basically what it did is it gave us a loan. But as we were shipping out prizes, we're kind of paying back the loan. I mean, we came out ahead to some degree, but I'd say more than half of the money we got was given back in prizes, and thrilled to do it. And the loan helped. I mean, it paid for two of the big actors, and that's what its purpose was. And having a part in doing that comic, you know, I actually published a comic with my hero movie dad, art dad, his art. And that alone was just like, I'll always have that. I worked with Richard on, to my mind, his best story ever. And so did I answer your question? I really got rambling there.
No, you did a great job in answering that question. When you were launching that Kickstarter, had you ever done a Kickstarter before? How did you go about promoting it? Or did you just know, because of those involved, people are going to find it?
No, we when you do them, you got to do them right. There are people out there that's their specialty. They'll try to get you. We had a lot of people approach us for a cut. They'll do all the social media and all that. That's probably the best way to promote a Kickstarter. And so I've got a guy named Brad Ross, who I've been working with for 15 years, and one of his 10,000 jobs, on top of which is being my assistant director, he handles all that social media. He's very good at it. We mostly hit the underground comics, all those creepy Vampirella, Eerie, the Warren magazines, Heavy Metal magazine was a big resource. So we did a lot of that. So we knew we were going to do it. I had done one before for my previous film, which I haven't even put out yet because I started on Mead right as I finished it and realized very quickly that Mead was 10 times the film of this other piece of crap. It'll be good when I re-edit it. But we did a Kickstarter on that. It was successful and it wasn't much. I mean, I didn't need much. But, I've, 90% or more is personally financed by me. There's no money that came in from anybody. I don't pay myself. I'm cheap child labor. So I do child. I'm 61. But, it's just the Kickstarter folks also added a level of enthusiasm. I mean, at the very end of the movie is all the Kickstarter backers, and we did an Indiegogo too, and they're all in there. And so I just pretend that's all the animators that would have
All
been. So I've got those credits in there, but it's not
right.
happening. But
I
we'll pretend it is.
mean, the talent involved is amazing. Like I said, you mentioned Patton Oswalt. You got Robert Picardo, who's a friend of the show. You have Patrick Walburton is in it as well. How did they get involved in the project, and what did each of them bring to the table?
Oh my gosh. Well, let's start with Patton Oswalt. Originally, I was after John Lithgow to play Mead, and he was in my head when I wrote the script. So I got to the point where that didn't line up because he had three projects that he was contracted to do, and he didn't have a start date on any of them. And he was scared if he added a fourth that he was going to screw somebody. So his agent actually came to us and pitched Patton and Patrick. And I really didn't know either of them very well. I'm embarrassed to say that, but I didn't know. I'd never seen King of Queens. I still haven't seen Ratatouille. I only knew Patton from being on a lot of CNN documentaries, The History of Comedy, and his wife, who did all that work catching the serial killer in California using her genealogy DNA system. So I knew about that, but I didn't know his voice. And I just told his agent, give me a couple of weeks to rinse my brain of John Lithgow's voice, who's one of my favorite actors of all time. He was just the guy. And I just started doing research on Patton, listening to his stuff, and realized this is our guy. And both Jan and I had a little trepidation, even going into the studio, because Patton did not want to read the script. He didn't want to know anything that's going on. Oh God, have I got a Marlon Brando here? But that wasn't the case at all. I believe what he was doing is he wanted to experience the story real time because we were doing it chronologically for him, not for anybody else, but for him. And I think he wanted to be surprised by things, and it would read, and it did. He was amazing, personable, sweetheart of a guy. And at the end, when we were done, and he was way ahead of schedule because he was so damn good. So I did the thing that they did with Robin Williams with Aladdin. I said, okay, I'm going to throw some scenarios at you, and I just want you to ad lib with anything you think of. And I did that for, oh, maybe 20, 30 minutes, because we were ahead of schedule. And I used every single one. He was so creative. Warburton plays Timmy the Wonderbot. And again, I found him through that same agent. And he was amazing. We spent more time talking about our boys than we did the project. And he did his part at his house. He has a studio. This is in the thick of COVID, of course. And he was amazing, very sweet man, very funny man. He said of me that I was the best director he ever worked with, that I was like the Castro of directors. And he goes, that's a terrible
Wait,
analogy.
Fidel Castro?
Fidel Castro.
Oh no, that's not good.
It's on our making of documentary that'll be on our DVD Blu-ray. But he's a funny man, did a great job. And then Picardo. I was working with an agent out of Las Vegas, and we were looking at Michael Ironside, you know, from Scanners and the Highlander 2, the one nobody wants to talk about, Starship Troopers. And then we were also looking at John DeLancey. You're just getting ready to start talking to him, and then Picardo. And this agent kept saying, well, this role needs Picardo, but you can't afford it. And I'd say, you're right, I can't. But I guess at some point she shipped off some of my animations and stuff to Picardo, and he started calling me. And we started talking about money, and he said, I can't afford you. And he says, well, how much you got? And I said, I've got this. And he'd go, yeah, I don't think you can afford me. And I'd say, okay. But we just never stopped talking. And he kept on coming back, said, can you do this? Can you? I said, I can't. I have this much set aside in escrow, and I can guarantee that when we're done, I can pay that. And I'm not going to promise anything more than I can do. And he says, I get you. And finally, I started feeling guilty about that, because I knew he got for a Star Trek convention about what I was offering. And at a point, I know this now, that he loves the project. It was a role that he really just was made to sink his teeth into. It's so different than the Doctor on Star Trek Voyager. I mean, both of them are assholes. They're just different kinds of assholes. And so he finally came back and accepted the role for the money I had. And I'd spent about a week just feeling guilty and like a shithead. I said my first bad word. Well, asshole is pretty bad, I guess. And when he called, I upped it to the level that our last conversation. And I think that's when he became my best friend.
But when you were to pay him.
Did you not hear me accept the original money you accepted, you offered? And I think he's one of the favorite things that about 25 actors and crew that were there when he was their favorite aspect of the production. I mean, he was funny. He was creative. We all learned stuff from him. I hope he learned something from me. Probably that doing green screen is really damn hard to do. But he just added so much, and he knew that character before he ever came. And all these actors came, they all knew their own lines. They knew everybody else's lines. They asked me questions to refine what I hoped to see in the characters, but they all had a really good sense of it. I got to tell you, not one actor in this thing was a prima donna. Not one actor did not understand what we were doing there. They were all funny. It was just a great family of creatives, those actors. And Bob was the king of them all. I mean, he was the guy everybody looked up to, was proud to be on screen with the guy. He's just one of the hardest working, most talented guys. And he's funny, great chef, knows his wine. Loves to laugh, and he would throw crap at these actors in the middle of a thing just to see if they could get through it without laughing. And this character, you know, could have been a snidely whiplash mustache swirling guy, and he was able to get across the humor. I mean, we messed with this character a lot, embarrassing stuff, and he still was able to get that humor across, and yet you were scared of him. And you knew that he was dangerous and probably going to kill us all. And, just that nuance alone was amazing. Robert Picardo, yeah. If you can get him, if you can afford him, he's the guy to call.
So the interesting thing is that, like I said, when you were working on Dark Star for those 10 years, you're talking about issues of confidence. When you're working on Mead, you worked on that part for 6 years. And as you're going along, you eventually get Picardo involved, you get Oswald involved, you get Patrick Wahlberg involved. Did that come with confidence, or were you already confident that this was going to be great before you suddenly got all these great actors involved?
Another good question. The first answer is just business, you know. There's a process you go through to get these people. At the end of the day, it's the money. I say that I don't know if that was 100% true of Picardo. I think there's some things that guy would do for nothing if he really believed in it. I really do. And he does a lot of very low budget salt and pepper independent projects, some that don't have near the budget or look that Mead had. And he does them and he's proud of them. A lot of people in his position distance themselves from projects. He's, oh, I want to only want people to remember me for Star Trek Voyager or whatnot. He's not that way at all. If he likes the project when it's done, he's proud of it and he talks about it. And he has no problem doing that.
So, well, one interesting thing about your movie that you're blending CGI with live action performances. Now, that's going to be challenging for the biggest studios to do correctly. How did you learn to meld the two of them together? And how were you able to draw the best performances in this very CGI green screen scenario?
Well, I give most of the credit to the actors for that, because all I could do is tell them who their character was and point at, you know, point A and point B of where they needed to move and where their eye line was. So that's really all I could do for them. I had to trust them to do their thing. As far as the compositing system I invented, I have some special sauces I use that people are probably not aware of that I'm not going to tell because they made it possible for me to do it. But the answer is I did not know until I composited the first few scenes that it was truly going to work, that people had, it wouldn't throw you out. It wouldn't make you go, I can't, if you can't believe it, you're screwed. And I did not know that until I was hundreds of thousands of dollars in, 4 years in, and it's like, okay, here's the day. And I waited 10 days before I tried it. After principal photography was done, I just had to go, oh God, oh God, oh God. And I just took one scene, here I go, and played with it and had to massage the shit out of it. And I actually, in those first 5 or 10 scenes, I had to develop my new system of how I made it work, and it did. Accidentally, I had no idea. But I lied to everybody and told them, yeah.
I mean, that's an incredible leap of faith. I mean, you're diving into a project, you're paying actors to do something that you're not yet sure if you actually can do, the major thing to make it all actually work.
Yeah. Well, the first guy who flew an airplane, or the first guy that ran out and a caveman pointed at a cow and told the caveman next to me, see that thing hanging down from that cow? I'm going to go squeeze it and I'm going to drink whatever comes out. You know, that's the same thing. You know, you have to take a leap of faith when you do anything. And good or bad, I was kind of inventing something that several members of my crew just weren't seeing it. I mean, I had a semi-mutiny going on at times, and I had to just tell them, back off, I know what I'm doing, trust me and listen to me. And that was a 15% lie. I was pretty damn confident I could pull it off, but I just had to tell them, just stop it, you know. I'm not going to do this in post. I want a real light over here that's going to help me sell this scene. I, you know, and it worked out. These people worked really hard, and we all did. It was the most difficult 18 days of everybody's lives, actors, crew, myself. There were two of the days I didn't sleep at all. I put in two days straight at, you know, 15 or 16 hours and did it again. And that's what you do. I mean, Picardo, I worried about him, you know, and I said, hey, you know, we might have some long days, maybe even a little over 12 hours. He went, never been on the Paramount, said, So and we all got through it, and it was a team effort, but it got rocky a few times. I mean, the gaffer and I almost came to blows on several occasions, and when we'd part ways at 2 a.m, he'd come up, say, come on, let's hug it out, and we'd hug it out, and the next morning we'd hug again, because we knew by about 8 o'clock at night that we were going to want to mash each other's faces. But we got through it. He was a really good professional. Enjoyed working with him. I'd do it again any day. His name's Tom Baker. He also shot some second camera, which we hadn't planned on shooting two cameras. And that was his suggestion. And we did that. And that helped us a little bit.
Now, another challenging aspect of this film is that it centers around meet a sentient spaceship presented in full CGI.
Yeah.
If the audience doesn't feel empathy for the sentient spaceship, the whole movie falls apart.
That's
and
right.
Most of our daily lives, we're not used to, we don't have experience with sentient spaceships. So so how did you create this character to ensure that the audience can see through the CGI, see through the artificiality of a spaceship, and feel the connection to the essence of it?
Well, to be clear, I didn't create it. Richard and Jan did, but I did take him to another level. I took his humor and really ramped that up. And again, I had John Lithgow in my head using, you know, how he would deliver lines. And that helped me. It's like Picardo said, one of the things that he was able to kind of draw from with his character had a lot to do with the wardrobe. And I've heard that a lot of times. Let your wardrobe do a lot of your acting and your development of your character. So it was a little bit similar with this great character and this great original idea of what it could do. And just taking, you know, my comedy writing and the idea of, you know, John Lithgow to Patton Oswalt delivering these lines and making it, you know, this had to, again, go from 16-page comic to a 105-minute film. And so we had to keep up that pace. We had to keep the humor going. And, you know, what was unique about all of the characters in here and how they interacted. And we created good puzzle pieces. So it kind of did itself.
So one interesting part of the story, according to Admiral Gillette, is passivity is its greatest threat.
Yes.
So in the mind of Admiral Gillette, what is the danger of being a pacifist, which inherently seems the least dangerous thing possible is to not want to fight. Why is it to Admiral Gillette that make it dangerous?
Well, I'll kind of tell you kind of his thinking. Some of it we don't allude to, but we may if we do other iterations of the story in the future. But the backstory is he's become a 4-star general. He's super powerful, and he manages to get this gig on Mercury Base, which is East Jesus, where nobody wants to go. And he's got this idea to create this fleet of 3 of these, what is called Deceptors. MEAD stands for, I always say motorized, mobile extrasensory autonomous Deceptor. So his idea is to build these things as the ultimate weapon and use them against the government of the solar system and take it over. So when errant programming from the programmer Tam, who ends up being a character we love, because her personality is imprinted on the MEAD units, they won't kill. And so now he's screwed. You know, he's got to cover this up. He's got these 3 units that, you know, and the pilots too, they've got to be executed. The MEAD units have to be destroyed, or else if his plan gets out, he's in trouble. Hmm. And I think he probably thought, I'll just do it again and I'll kill her too. So this doesn't happen again. Well, this doesn't happen because Tam helps MEAD and Frizz escape. So the other 2 pilots and the other 2 MEAD units were destroyed. So that's kind of his motivation, but it's more of it was always a Moby Dick, Ahab metaphor. This guy is just bent. I don't want to give away spoilers, but you know what I'm talking about. Things happen that make him just, I'm gonna get them. And he's willing to break the rules. He's willing to go against the, whatever you call them, the fleet's orders and make his own orders. And he tries to convince everybody that MEAD is dangerous. Which he's not. I mean, there's a question that Sternhagen asks him, you know, hey, so they MEAD beyond the Deceptor capabilities, they've got guns, lasers, all that, right? And he goes, state of the art. And then Sternhagen goes, why haven't they fired a single shot? And he just looks at him, you know. And so they start to kind of figure things out. So my actors thought they were the bad guys, you know, the crew of the Achilles that Gillette was commanding to go after MEAD. And I kept telling, you're not the bad guys. You're following orders. And eventually, at the end, maybe your bad guys will get the idea that they need to do something and follow the real orders from the universe, not this insane guy after a big white whale.
So when and where can our listeners find Mead?
Okay, I'm going to cheat here. Vision Films. My partners, my distributors, I love them. They're great. But I got to get this crap right, or the owner, Lisa Romanoff, gets really angry at me. And I mean this tongue in cheek, that she says, you've got to get these right. So I'm going to read this. She sent it to me today just for you. So Mead will be available on all pay-per-view or VOD on-demand channels on your cable, telco, or satellite services throughout the USA and Canada. Also digitally on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, Vudu, and Vimeo on demand, as well as some educational and library platforms. There will be a lot more. This is just what's contracted right now before our release of August 9th. Mm. It'll also be available for order on Best Buy, Walmart, and Amazon.com. So that's what we got right now, you know. So
what's the day of availability in all these locations?
August 9th is our release date. Yeah, you can already go on some of them and do pre-orders. I got an email that's going on. The reason we won't have the DVDs and Blu-rays ready right on the release date, they'll be a few weeks late, is because I've been really hammering on getting the menu the way I want it, and it's gorgeous. They're doing an awesome job. A guy named Jeffrey Miller and a guy named Charles over there at Arrow, and of course Jake at Vision Films, and Val at LADB in Los Angeles. I've been busting their balls, man. It's like, this has got to be better. This has got to be better. And because of that, we ran a little late, but it'll be available. I've already got a test run that, I got one. Oh yeah, here's one. So see if I can get it up there. Yeah.
Very cool.
So yeah, we've already got, that's a Blu-ray, and you know, the disc and the booklet in there and everything. And it is just gorgeous, but it had a few bugs I wasn't happy with. And we worked through it together, and it's going to be a great pack. Lots of extras. It's got the trailers. It's got the documentary. It's got an incredible chapter surfing functionality. It's got closed caption, and it's got the Spanish subtitles. So it's not just it's a really good package. And the we had to use the double-sided discs on both DVD and Blu-ray because I wanted it just to look, we did everything in 4K, right? We haven't yet, we may in the future do a 4K, but I wanted it to look 4K, and it does. It looks really good. The surround sound was done by Bill Bruce in Nashville, Tennessee, a guy I've been working with since he was 18 years old, you know, and I was, how old was I? 20, 28. And we've been working together ever since we were in that band together. And we both went into production because rock and roll wasn't going to pay our rent. So he did the surround sound that came out just amazing. When I heard it in the theater, you know, a spaceship flies by, just roars past your head to the back speakers and shakes the ground. And it's just because we just stuck with it. You know, we can't compromise on anything. The sound went through 8 sessions in Premiere and 4 more in Pro Tools. And then it went to build to get started. So we really, the detail in this, it was very important. Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it.